So, a short recap of what we did yesterday. We were basically speaking about the Mahajans. Mahajano yena gata sapanta. A verse that was spoken by Yudhisthira Maharaj in the Mahabharata. And that verse is establishing that tarka pratista shudhiyo vibhina. That by logic, one can analyze the Shruti, the scriptures, but through logic, one all reaches different conclusions. Nasa varisya matana binam. And different rishis, again and again, different rishis are coming forward, and these rishis are all mata, their own opinion, nabinam. And one is disagreeing with the other. Yeah. So, this is what the verse is saying. When we interpreted the Vedic scriptures on the basis of logic, then different scholars will be disagreeing with each other. And then it says, Dhammasya tattvam nihitam guhayam. The Dharma tattva, Dhammasya tattva, or the truth of religious principle, nihitam guhayam, remains hidden. Guhayam, hidden in the heart of the saintly personalities, of the great devotees. And therefore, Mahajana yena gata sapanta. Of course, there was some unrest because of the latecomers, so most of you missed everything I said. And you didn't register it at all. If I ask anyone to repeat what I just said, few would be able to do it. So I'll have to do it again. Okay, so now take a deep breath, fasten your seatbelt, and again, it's basically that by logically interpreting the scriptures, so many personalities are all getting different opinions, and the true conclusions of the Vedas are hidden from such scholars. It is only the pure devotees who actually know the conclusions of the scriptures within their heart through realization. Such pure devotees are our examples. They are the great souls, Mahajana yena gata sapanta, and we are following the path of the Mahajans. Then in Srimad Bhagavatam, there are Dvadas Mahajan, 12 Mahajans listed, and they are as follows. The 12 Mahajans from Srimad Bhagavatam, again, listen carefully. Svayambhu Narada Shambhu, Kumaro Kapilu Manu, Praladu Janaku Bhismu, Balir Vayasaki Vayam. So it begins with Svayambhu, the self-born. Lord Brahma is the self-born. And then Manu, it's talking about Swayambhu Manu. So Swayambhu is not talking about Maya, it's talking about Brahma, the self-born. Swayambhu Manu is the one who came from Brahma, the mental son of Brahma, that Manu. He's a special one. Because he's the son of Manu, the first one who is chosen together with his wife, Satarupa, who is actually in the Vedic culture, they are the Adam and Eve. Because actually in the beginning, it is Lord Brahma who is alone within the universe on the lotus flower. And then from his mind manifest all these different sages. And he orders these sages to populate the universe, but it's not happening. So it is described in Bhagavatam. They were not so inspired. But then he creates Swayambhuva Manu. And actually from the body of Swayambhuva Manu, he creates the female form. And so that is close to the biblical history of Adam and Eve, where Eve is also comes from the body of Adam, from a rib and so on. So actually we see Swayambhuva Manu is the first male in the universe that will have a female in the form of Satarupa, is good wife. And then from them, the population of the universe begins to take place. Therefore, we're speaking of mankind, man who are the descendants of Manu. They are the descendants of Manu. Therefore, Manu is the special authority. You cannot question Manu, right? Not possible. You cannot question Manu as an authority. If anyone begins to question Manu as an authority, then you're like, okay. You know, anyone wants to question Narada as an authority. Anyone. Narada is a spiritual body. If that's, and he can go wherever he likes in the material and the spiritual world. So no one, no matter what, no Rishi, no matter what his opinion is, what can he say when in front of Narada? What can he argue against Manu? So then Brahma himself, he is Pitamaha, the original grandfather. One cannot argue. Right? Then we have Kumara. We find in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita that, but it is generally stated that the Brahmacharis worship Sanat Kumar, because we remember they were also mental sons of Brahma, sages, and Brahma ordered them to create a population in the universe, and they refused. They didn't want to do it, and they decided to stay 5 years old, because they realized that 5 years is the best. So if you're younger than five, then you still are not completely clear about things. But five is the age of pragya. Five is the age where you sort of know. You know how things work when you're five. You have some idea. But at the same time, when you're five, you can do anything you want. You can walk in any house and they say, oh, come in, you know. You just walk in the house of some stranger, if you like. You take an apple, what? And they will say, oh, please, take more. Oh, yes. Yeah. When you're five, anything you do is okay. Yeah. So five is a good age. So the four Kumaras decided to stay 5 years of age. At that age, there is no question of sex desire. There are no duties yet. Don't have to go to school when you're five, see? So they figured it all out. Five was a very good age. So they decided to stay five. So it is said that these Kumaras, they were specially empowered incarnations of the Supreme Lord. Namely, Lord Brahma, he was alone in the universe. He was meditating on the lotus flower for inspiration to take on the creation. And it said from within, the Supreme Lord eventually revealed to him that knowledge. So then he began to do the secondary creation of the universe, Sarga and Visarga. The primary creation is where the universes come from the poreholes of Mahavishnu, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu enters, all the ingredients are there, and then Lord Brahma does the secondary creation known as Visarga. Alright, Lord Brahma was so engaged, and in the cause of that, he has to provide for the conditioned souls. And because the conditioned souls in the material world want to forget Krishna, Lord Brahma had to also create the influence of nescience and forgetfulness of transcendental knowledge. He had to do it as a matter of duty, but he didn't like it. He didn't like it at all. Therefore, he created the four Kumaras next, immediately after that, and they were empowered to invest the world with knowledge. Therefore, the four Kumaras and the eldest Sanat Kumar are particularly counting as very important empowered incarnations of the Lord, and they are Brahmacharis. So, in the Vedic literatures, it is stated that if one is a lifetime Brahmachari, right, then one can be promoted very high in the universe. A pious Grihastha, A pious grihasta can attain Swark, the heavenly planets, and there enjoy for a long time heavenly pleasures and so on. Higher still are pious souls who are detached. They can become Prajapatis. Above Swark are the Jana Mahar Tapa Loka and then Brahma Loka. Jana Mahar Tapa and then Brahma Loka. So on Jana Loka is the residence of the Prajapatis, the Prajapatis who are populating the universe. Then on the Mahar Loka is the residence of great sages. These great sages are always performing austerities and always absorbed in worshipping the Lord and completely celibate. Then still higher than that, is the abode for the lifetime brahmacharis. And that abode is known as the Siddhaloka, or Tapaloka also. So there in Tapaloka, the brahmacharis reside. And there, their worshipable deity is Sanat Kumar. Because Sanat Kumar is a Shakti Avesh avatar of the Lord. So he appears before them and he is the inspiration there. Of course they worship Lord Vishnu, but Sanat Kumar is the Vaya Media. And Sanat Kumar has a feature which is residing eternally in Vaikuntha. But from time to time he manifests on Tapaloka. And in this way, as a resident of Vaikuntha, he is inspiring the Tapalokas. So just to have an idea who Sanat Kumar is. Right? Therefore, it is not surprising that the Kumaras were, for example, instructing Prithu Maharaj. It is then also not surprising that there is one of the four sampradayas that is coming from the Kumaras. I mean, such personalities. Sanat Kumar is a resident of Vaikuntha who comes down to the material world. He's not even a great personality of this world, but he's directly a Vaikuntha Basi. So, understanding this, what an authority he is. Anyone who wants to argue with Sanat Kumar? No. Okay, Kumaru Kapilo, who's Kapila, of course, also known as an incarnation of the Lord, a Yuga avatar, and instructing Devahuti. So these are not just ordinary yogis or scholars, these are incarnations of the Lord. So they are kind of authorities that are hard to argue with, you see. Kapila. I mean, if
Kardamuni.
Not Kardamuni. Kapila. Kardamuni, that's another story.
Kapila is son of Kardamuni.
I know that, Mahatma. You're talking too much. That's a totally different topic. We don't want to talk about his father, father's name. No. We want to talk about Kapila, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as an authority. He's a greater authority than Kardamamuni, because he's the Supreme Lord. Yeah? You see the point? Therefore, Kapila, and then secondary is Kardamamuni. Primary authority is Kapila, not Kardamamuni. Although he's his father, he's his elder. But in this case, the son is a greater authority than the father. Therefore, Kapila, not Kardamamuni. No, I am sorry. Kapila is our authority. Yes. So, Kumaru, Kapilo, Manu, yes. And then, Prahlado, you want to argue with Prahlad? I wouldn't advise it because you might wind up in the Sringadev. So, whatever Prahlad says, yes, very nice. So, Prahlad, again, such an authority. If anyone wants to argue with the authority of Prahlad, then we request them, speak to Nisringadev. You see? So again, a very strong authority. Prahladu, Janako, the father of Sita. It's like in all of India, who would argue against Janak Maharaj, the father of Sita? It's difficult. Difficult, again. So again, such an authority. It doesn't matter whether you belong to this sampradaya, that sampradaya, or this, that, but Janak Maharaj, everyone will accept as a great saint. You have to. That is, you cannot argue with this. Yeah. I know that Bhishma comes next. Pralado Janako Bhishmo. So, Bhishma Dev was pierced with hundreds of arrows, and he is lying on this bed of arrows, and he was completely peaceful, and he was still instructing the Pandavas about giving them transcendental instructions about this, about devotional service to the Supreme Lord. So if anyone is doubting the spiritual power of Bhishma Dev, then we request them to stand. We will shoot 100 arrows through them, and then they can lie on a bed of arrows, and if they can do what Bhishma Dev did, then we'll listen to them. So anyone wants to argue with about Bhishma, I'll bring my bow and arrow and I'll shoot the arrows. So Pralado Janako Bhishmo Balir Vayasiki Vayam. Bali Maharaj, right? He had everything. He had the whole universe. In his possession. We have something, but nobody has as much as Bali Maharaj. There have been great kings, very wealthy, very powerful, but Bali Maharaj had the entire universe. Then Vamanadev came, asked for three steps of land. By two steps, he took the whole universe. Sukracharya told Bali Maharaj, don't give it. Don't do it. He's tricking you. Bali Maharaj said, no, I gave my word. I will give. So he gave. He gave away the whole universe. Who would do that? We say, yes, yes, and we do no, no. And like that, to keep one's word at any cost, at the cost of possessing the whole universe, is more than anything we have. That's Bali Maharaj. Therefore, Bali Maharaj is such a Mahajan, such an authority. His faith in Lord Vamana was so great. So again, he is the authority. And Vyasaki is Vyasadeva himself, the writer of the Vedas. So, alright, so in this way, we can see that the 12 Mahajans, the Dwadas Mahajan, are very strong authorities. You cannot just argue with them. It is not so so simple. And now, the Srimad Bhagavatam, why, this question comes up in discussion sometimes, why so much emphasis on Srimad Bhagavatam? Because in Srimad Bhagavatam, all these personalities are speaking. It's actually all they are speaking. In other, why not other Puranas? The other Puranas are saying they are just as good. Every Purana is saying, yes, that may be. In other Puranas, there are other sages speaking. And these sages are also undoubtedly great personalities. But yet, even they are not as great as the Mahajans. You see, even they are under the authority of the Mahajans. All because the Mahajans are first. Narada is first. Brahma is the very first. Right? So everyone is under the authority of Brahma. And everyone, and next is Narada. Everyone is under the authority of Narada. He is Deva Rishi. He is the Rishi under the Devas. Yeah? So even the Devas are under Narada. Everyone is under Narada. So in this way, Bhagavatam gives us all these authorities. They are speaking. Narada is speaking. He's speaking to Vyas. Vyas is speaking. Kapila is speaking to his mother Devahuti, giving transcendental instructions. the Kumaras. So like this. These are our authorities. So that's more or less where yesterday spent my time in more detail on establishing these authorities and the authority of Srimad Bhagavatam, so that we could understand that our movement is not a modern movement. Still, then yesterday I took it to the more modern part of our movement. Because our movement is rooted in the classical Vedic times, and our movement is also rooted in the medieval times, when Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared in 1486. Did Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu change anything? No, I pointed out yesterday that he presented his teachings on the basis of a number of scriptures. One was the Brahma Samhita. He took the Brahma Samhita, and the Brahma Samhita is right in the center of our movement. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu found that Brahma Samhita in South India, he was very, very inspired. He spread it widely, and this Brahma Samhita is 100% authorized. We follow it 100%, not one word that we don't follow. So if anyone is asking, what is your philosophy, then we just take the Brahma Samhita, say, here, read this. Tell him, read it. That's it. You know? Why are you saying that Krishna is supreme? We are not saying that Krishna is supreme. Brahma is saying that Krishna is supreme. Argue with him. Right? If you want. Yes? If you want to argue, don't argue with me. Argue with this Brahma Samhita, if you want. Argue with that. Argue with Brahma's words, you see, what we are saying. So, in this way, we have to understand the authority of what we are part of, the roots of what this movement is, and that. But then in the modern times comes, as he said, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So one, he bases his teachings on Brahma Samhita. Two, Srimad Bhagavatam is the main evidence that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is presenting. And also, his principal disciples, the six Goswamis, and the leader of the six Goswamis is Rupa Goswami. So, for example, the Nectar of Devotion that we are reading is the book of Rupa Goswami, and where he has taken many Vedic types of evidence for supporting the process of bhakti, as he heard it from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Nana Shastra Vicharana Kanipano Sadharma Samstapako. He studied many scriptures and then established Vedic conclusions. Thank you. And I once did a count, right, of how many quotes there are of Bhagavatam in the Nectar Devotion, and came to 112. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is quoted 112 times in the Nectar Devotion. I mean, that's very substantial, right? It means it is a big authority throughout Rupa Goswami's work, because Bhagavatam is our main authority. Yesterday I also pointed out that in the Chandogya Upanishad, the Bhagavat is, that means Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Purana, are established as the fifth Veda. So it is Veda, not only Chaturvedi, no. Even the fifth, it is also counted as Veda. Ramayana, Mahabharata, the Itihas, the Purana, they're all counted as Veda, yes, in the Chandogya Upanishad. So there are those who say only the four Vedas are bona fide. Now these four Vedas, Rig Veda, Ayurveda, Samaveda, Atharva Veda, each Veda is further subdivided. In the Vedas there are Samhitas, there are Brahmanas, Aranyakas, and Upanishads. So that's how you divide up the Vedas. The Samhitas are basically giving us prayers that are used in sacrifice. Yes, and then the Brahmanas are giving us instructions as to how to properly pronounce the various mantras and so on, that are used in sacrifice, and some further detail on how to perform the rituals and so on. Yes, and then the Aranyakas give us the philosophy of the sacrifice. And generally speaking, the Brahmanas, those scriptures, and Samhitas were studied by householders who lived in the cities. And the Aranyakas were generally studied by sages in the forest. And then there are the Upanishads. And the Upanishads, they give the philosophy of the Vedas, the underlying spiritual principles. So what do we find? That most of the Vedic ritual are dealing with karma kanda, ritual that give us material profit in this world, benefit for the body, some benefit for the body, even up to Swarg, heavenly planets. And but the Upanishads are dealing not with the karma kanda, but the jnana kanda, and they are dealing with inquiring into the goal of life, the ultimate goal of life, and they are concerned with liberation and with Brahman. Then there are a few verses here and there in the Vedas that are dealing with the Upasana Kanda, with the worship of the Supreme Lord. There are some Upanishads that are completely dealing with the Supreme Lord, like Gopaltapani Upanishad deals with the worship of Krishna, and so on. And there are other verses found everywhere and throughout the Vedas that are part of the Upasana section of the Vedas. So this is all the four Vedic literatures. And these Puranas, there are 18 Mahapuranas, and some are in, for those people in Tamagun, they worship Shiva, some for those people in Rajagun, they worship Brahma, and the ones that worship Vishnu are considered to be the Sattvic Puranas. There are six, or five actually, including Padma Purana, Vishnu Purana, and then the Bhagavad Purana is the topmost Purana. So I'm not, this is not an opinion of a Rishi. This is simply an analysis for you of Vedic literature. Just an overview. The Vedanta Sutra is basically a summary in code form. If after one had studied all the Vedic literature, one was meant to study Vedanta Sutra. And the Vedanta Sutra, these sutras are designed in such a way that from there, one who knows all the scriptures gets a basic outline and structure. And then from the outline of the Vedanta Sutra, he can fill it in with detailed knowledge about all the scriptures. That's the idea. So therefore the Vedanta Sutra is sort of the condensed form, and therefore everyone tries to have a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. And of course, the Gaudiya Vaishnavas have their commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, known as the Govinda Bhasya by Baladev Vijayabhusan. And Jiva Goswami did it again in the Tattva Sandarbha. He also commented on the first four verses of the Vedanta Sutra, and that is those are the essential verses to comment on. There are four anuchedas. It's not exactly verses, they are like lengthy sections that he commented on. So, just to give you some idea that there is a very large scholarly foundation. I know I should have had maps for you and slideshows, and I would have had, but there were too many bookings, and in between the bookings there were too many people who came to my room also, and then in between I confess that I slept and sometimes even ate and other times, believe it or not, I was chanting japa. So, couldn't make the PowerPoints and all these things for you this time. So you have to do it without audio-visual support and just do it through the Srotapanta, or the traditional way of hearing. What can I say? That's how it used to be. So I'm going traditional here. All right, now I'm with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is presenting the knowledge based of Brahma Samhita and of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, it seems that there are some differences between what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is teaching and what the rest of, and what many others in India are following. For one thing, it seems that he and his followers were not worshipping the demigods. That's true, but of course Krishna says also in the Bhagavad Gita, he says several times that if we worship Anya Devata, that then our knowledge is stolen by illusion. He says things like that. So, if we read the Gita carefully, we see that it also lines up. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gives us the deeper meaning of the Vedas. There are many levels of the Vedas. Do a little auspicious ritual. Hang a lemon on your mirror, a chili on your mirror, put some lemon under the wheels of the car. A pumpkin for your new house. All these things, I say, these things are there. And these things, no, this is not just nonsense. There is rituals that by which we, through those pumpkins, we can capture negative elements, negative spirits, and negative karmic reactions in mantra. They enter into that pumpkin. We burn the pumpkin with fire. Throw it out. They're all out. House is clean. So in this way one can clean a house from all kinds of spirits and negative influences. So that's nice. And one said, well, why not, you know? If it's so easy, why not? We sacrifice a pumpkin for a house, no problem. Anytime. So we're very happy when someone comes and does a pumpkin ceremony for us. yes? I was in one program and they asked the devotees to make an offering of the book. So one brahmachari arranged it that there were two people holding a chadar, and then behind the chadar he had very loud bell, and then at one point there was a lot of smoke because he lit a whole bundle of incense. So much smoke came from behind that chadar, and such loud bells and so many mantras, and everyone said, oh, this is really prasad. This is really powerful prasad. So it is actually not, the strength is not depending on how loud we ring the bell or how much smoke there is. The strength is actually depending on the bhakti. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita we find a description that Mother Sachi, before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took sannyas, had one more week to cook for her son Nimai. And said, then she cooked. And at that time, the prasadam, it was extraordinary. No one had ever tasted prasadam like that. And they just, by eating it, not only the taste, but they just felt overwhelmed with devotional ecstasy immediately. Because the bhakti of the cook is actually entering into that prasadam. And the more the cook displays bhakti, the more Krishna is accepting that offering. And the more it is invested with transcendental potency. So there is prasadam in prasadam. You know what I mean? If you buy something from the supermarket and you sort of read the label and the label, yeah, it's okay. Ting, 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 you know, okay, prasadam. That's okay. It is. But there is prasadam and prasadam, if you know what I'm talking about. So she offered it with great bhakti. So bhakti supersedes ritual. That is the principle. It is bhakti that is really what can purchase Krishna. Krishna, there are many verses like that. It said Krishna is much more pleased when his parents are chastising him, than by the hymns of the Sama Veda chanted by various Brahmanas. Right? When Yasoda is raising the stick, oh, Krishna is more pleased with that. Yes. Because that is based on love. That is okay, the other thing, our religious duty, that is different. So in this way, we have to understand that the key to the Supreme Personality of Godhead is bhakti. And Bhagavad Gita established that. So, Rupa Goswami. Last year I came here, and Atul Krishna was also there at that time. You know him. And I was speaking on Chaitanya Charitamrita, and I invited him to speak something on Bangladesh, because, you see, over the years, as I was studying the history of our movement and the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, I realized that, well, that Bengal had been cut in half by the British, right? And that a whole piece of India had become Bangladesh and a Muslim country by the arrangements of our friends from the UK. Anyhow, what shall we say? So, with that, they cut the history of our movement in half. So, part of our history is on the Indian side and part is on the Bangladeshi side. So, by reading over the years, I was quite aware of that. And so, since Atul was there here in Melbourne, and I know that he spent a lot of time in Bangladesh and that he married even a Bangladeshi girl, right? I knew that, right? So I thought, okay, let's hear from him a little bit about Bangladesh. So some of you may remember who were here at the time that we had a map of Bangladesh, we're projecting and pointing at different places. Well, we didn't leave it at that. After that, I got together again with Atul and I said, well, Atul, we should go to Bangladesh, right? So we did, and we took a group of 30 men only, because I wasn't quite sure what the facilities would be like, and I thought, take ladies, maybe more complicated also. Muslim country can also be more complicated. So I thought, keep life simple and just take men only, which maybe was a good idea. We went to different places. We went to the northeast of the country, to Sylhet. And there's a lot in the area of Sylhet. There is the birthplace of Jagannath Mishra, Sachimata. There is the birthplace of Advaita Acharya. There is a place dedicated to Murari Gupta, where he resided. Some say his birthplace. We do not agree. But he lived there. And then there is a place dedicated to Sivananda Sen, who is a big leader amongst Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's devotees. Srivas Pandit's house, Srivas Thakur, his birthplace is also there. So these are all very important personalities to our tradition. And they're all there around Sylhet. So we went to Sylhet. It was nice. We entered the city of Sylhet with 30 devotees in 4 vans, Toyota vans. We were driving into the town, and suddenly there were 40 to 50 motorbikes appearing in front of us, and there were two devotees in front on each motorbike, dressed in dhoti kurta, and one was standing on the back on each motorbike with the hands raised, and they started to call out, Gauranga Nityananda, Gauranga Nityananda, and like that, with this escort, we came into town. And all the Muslims were looking like, what is that? So it was a nice entrance into Sylhet. And then the local devotees really looked after us very well. And they took us all over. And we went to the birthplace of Advaita Acharya. We had to cross two rivers and go over rough terrain and tempos and this and that. It was not so easy to get there. And when we finally got out there, we got somewhere on a riverbank, just on the border of Bangladesh, next to Meghalaya, next to the hills of Meghalaya. And there in that birth site of Advaita Acharya, ISKCON has a project. They don't know exactly where the place is. Within a range of 5 to 10 kilometers, they sort of know where it is. So in that area we have an ashram. And it was a little simple. At night there were two devotees. They had a rat in their mosquito net. So maybe it was good to leave the ladies home. I think that's where the limit is it? No rats in the mosquito nets, is it? So, you can encounter a little bit of that, but there must be devotee rats. Whatever. We had to brave it. Later we traveled to other places on the southwest, not far from the Indian border. We came to the birthplace of Rupa and Sanatan, and there also we had some adventures because, as we know, in Bangladesh the rainy season is proficient, and there is the rivers are very large and they're overflowing, and there's always some flooded areas. So as we went to the birthplace of Rupa and Sanatan, suddenly a whole body of water had appeared in between us and that birthplace that normally wasn't there. But our tour guide, who was a devotee named Charu Chandra, who is the national secretary for Bangladesh, he was touring us around. He was something like Tarzan in the jungle. He was completely at home. He immediately found somewhere a boat, and he, like one of these really like tiny little boat, sort of carved out of wood, one of those, and he was paddling us across, and it all went well until one group, somehow or other, someone in the boat stood up, and then the boat sunk with all the devotees. So that was also nice, especially because we were on the shore taking pictures. As they were going down. So we had lots of fun. It was good. And then we came to the birthplace of Rupa and Sanatan Goswami. Somehow or other, in India or Bangladesh, wherever you go, when you go to a holy place, there's always a tree. Yeah? Somehow or other, I don't know, ladies must have given birth under trees, because wherever you go, there always is a tree, or they put a tree, something like this. Right? Anyway, there was a tree. We touched our head to the tree. There were deities of Srila Rupa and Sanatana Goswami. And we understand that they are eternal residents of the spiritual world who came down. When Krishna comes down, and when Krishna comes again to this world in the form of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then Krishna brings with him also his intimate associates. So Rupa Goswami is Rupa Manjari, one of the intimate associates of Lalita Devi. So in this way, Rupa Manjari has a very principal role to play. Lalita is, of course, a close associate of Srimati Radharani. In that way, we have our connection. Our acharyas were not ordinary people. One after another, great, powerful personalities appeared by the arrangement of Krishna. And these great personalities brought us this special quality of the essence of the Vedas, right? Which is full surrender. Not that we approach Krishna for some benediction for our life here, but that we approach Krishna. Not that we approach Krishna for our pleasure, but that we approach Krishna for His pleasure. You see, that is the greatest. That is the greatest. And that is, of course, the essence of this movement. So we should not doubt the authority of this movement. And the fact that there are differences, that is no wonder, because there are levels of Vedic culture. When Vyasadeva wrote Vedic literatures, he wrote literatures for people on all kinds of levels, so that everyone could connect. But obviously we can understand that if you do some ritual to get some blessings, some puja with some brahmana, and you give some donation, that that is not the same as giving your whole life. That's clear. So we can understand by the arguments I gave from scriptures, by connecting us to the Mahajans, by analyzing the Vedic literature, and now coming to the contents of what these devotees are displaying, selfless service for the pleasure of Krishna. That is the essence of spiritual life. So we see in the whole world, we see that most people who are involved with some religion do it to get some benediction for themselves from God. And that doesn't matter whether they are Christians or Muslims or Hindus or whatever they are. Jews, all the same. They all want the blessings for themselves. But here we're talking about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement, which wants this complete dedication of the devotee for the pleasure of Krishna. Therefore, this movement is a step up, and we all feel that for everyone. It doesn't matter where we come from, whether you come from the Netherlands, of course, the Netherlands, the lowlands, right? In French or Spanish, they're called Pays Bas or Países Bajos, the lowlands, the lowest lands. It's true, it's the lowest country in the world. So I can claim that I've taken the lowest birth. Right? I can say so, because I come from the lowest country, below sea level. Yes. So, but, and in other ways also, but, wherever we come from, this movement takes us up very quickly. Very quickly, because in this movement there is no compromise. There is this Muslim speaker from Indian origin who is quite well known and who attracts very large crowds. And his name is Zakir Nayak, right? Some of you may have heard of Zakir Nayak, some of you may have not heard of Zakir Nayak. That's all. If you haven't, it doesn't matter. But many people, and you always, he is a PhD also. He has learned PhD. And he sometimes speaks on Hinduism. So as a Muslim, in front of 100,000 Muslims, he speaks on Hinduism. And he begins to cite from Hindu scripture. And he says in the Manu Samhita, and then he gives verse numbers, chapter, whole bunch of numbers. It is said that eating of meat is totally authorized. This is totally authorized. And he gives all the scripture, all the numbers, all the verse numbers. Well, if I give a seminar on the Manu Samhita, then you can indeed see that Zakir Nayak is not wrong. He is right. There are many rituals in there for taking flesh. And even the brahmanas, yes, can take. Ho, ho, ho. What's going on? Are we being cheated in this place? All this time we thought you had to be a vegetarian, so much trouble it gave in the family. And now it comes out, so much difficulty, yes. You can't go anywhere, can't eat anything at work, always like, well, what will you have for lunch? Well, give me some salad, at best. And now it comes out in the Manu, by the mercy of Zakir Nayak. He is citing the Vedic scripture. And now we hear that actually it's all right to eat meat. Manusamhita, Manu, Manu, one of the authorities, you told us Manu. Ah, Manu, Manu, ah, you told, yes. So here we are now in a predicament. Oh my God, what to do now? Manusamhita, Babri Bab. What are we going to do? This is a complication. So, what about this? Yes. Yes. It is possible to eat meat or flesh of animals in a Vedic ritualistic way, but this is a lower path in the Vedas. This is a lower path. Therefore, you cannot just go and look for some verse. We can explain to Zakya Nayak, yes, yes, these verses are there, but this Manusamhita is only the Dharma Shastra, and the Dharma Shastra is basically giving you directions that cover material life, and mostly they deal with karma kanda, with improving the material conditions of life, which are temporary, and therefore in itself of a lower nature. The higher part of the Vedas deals with the eternal, so we're speaking about that, and then we have plenty of verses where the eating of flesh is forbidden. Panam, jutam, striyam, sunam, chaturvidha adhammascha. Yes, that these four are the cause of adhamma. Yes, panam, jutam, striyam, sunam. That means, okay, intoxication, meat eating, gambling, and illicit sex. So these things are definitely there. So we see that the Vaishnavas function on a higher standard. Sometimes you read the Manusamhita, it's very strict. It says that the Brahmana, before he studies the Vedic literature, he has to fast. He has to fast. And then after fasting and so on, finally after purification, he's ready to begin his studies of Vedic literature. Then, if one sudra passes by and he sees that sudra, he has to fast again. He has to take bath, fast again. So if we would have that in this day and age, you would never come to reading at all. Okay? I mean, we would never read one letter. Not practical. No, you have to. So we can see, we know that in some places, these smarta brahmanas who were following this smriti to the letter, they imposed heavy restrictions on the lower caste. Anyone who was non-brahmana was lower caste. And that when a sudra had to come into their area to do some cleaning work and do some untouchable work, he had to call, had to ring a bell, you know, because even touching the shadow of such a sudra is contaminating. And again, bath and fast, finished. So lots of bath and lots of fast. Yes. So the smarta, actually India has been in the grip of the smartas for a very long time. Yes. For at least a period of 1,000 years or more, the smartas have very much predominating India. And it's like everything in Manusamhita was practically the law book. Actually, the formal law book of India was the Manusamhita until 1955. Interesting that even during the British Raj, the Manusamhita survived, and only after the British Raj they gave it up. All that trouble to keep it during the whole era of the British and then to give it up after. Very bad. What can I say? In 55, he gave it up. Yes, so that was the formal law book of India up to 1955. Then we got in modern copy of British law, actually. Yes, they based Indian law on British law. Of course, now it has its own precedents and so on, and its own history, and therefore it has developed into a law system of its own, but therefore the Indian law system is the same as European law, actually. Whereas previous, up to 1955, Manusamhita. Interesting, isn't it? Anyway, so we see that the smartas have predominated India for a long time, but reading the Manusamhita, we can immediately see These Brahmanas are performing great austerities, they're fasting, they can't see a sudra, this, that, fasting again, austerity. But then they eat meat. In regulated ways, for special yajnas. Oh. But of course, scriptures tell us that even for the Karmakanda, this is forbidden for the age of Kali. Asvamedam kavalambam akalo panchavivarjayet. So the Asvamedha Yajna, which was performed by great kings, even Gavalamba, even cow sacrifices, where the Brahmanas would sacrifice a cow and revive that cow through mantra, is forbidden for the age of Kali, according to scripture. Good. So, that is why I was speaking about black cats yesterday. I told the story about the marriage and how this black cat appeared and how it was kept under the basket, and somehow or other, from that day on in that family, there always was a black cat under a basket. And I gave some examples. I said, Pitri Paksha, that particular period of the months where you are offering the Shraddha to the Pitris, to the forefathers, became Pitar Pak. When you offer whoever is deceased his favorite things, Fat 69, he loved it too much. So, to his picture and some of his favorite cigars. That's nuts. So, that is a perversion of the original tradition. So, we are here actually in a movement which is of the highest quality, and it demands the highest quality. So we don't have to feel, when we meet other people from Indian origin who know something about Vedic tradition, we don't have to feel that we have to defend ourselves, that we are cornered. Why are you not doing this puja? I don't know. Why are you not following Shivratri? Huh? Are you Indian? Shivratri? It's very serious, no? I mean, Mahaparat. No, actually, we are worshipping Lord Shiva, Vaishnavanam Yathashambhu, as a Vaishnava. But as the devotee of Krishna, we are accepting Lord Shiva. So we can offer respect to him on Shivratri. But I pointed out yesterday, we're not doing separate puja, nor are we taking prasad. But respect we are offering, always, always. And we're worshipping him as a Vaishnava. Can we worship Hanuman? Hanuman is a bhakta. Yes, worship Hanuman, no problem. Good. Can we chant Hanuman Chalisa? Well, not everything in Hanuman Chalisa is considered 100% coming from parampara, unfortunately. It's therefore, not every word in the Hanuman Chalisa is considered authorized. You mean I can no longer chant Hanuman Chalisa? No. Mercilessly, no more Hanuman Chalisa. Why? Well, because our Vaishnava Acharyas, they were dedicating themselves to Krishna fully, fully, and in worshipping only what comes down in the Sampradaya. Sampradaya bihina ye mantra nisvala mantra. Without going through the Sampradaya, the mantra will not produce the appropriate result. It's as simple as that. So, the nice thing about this movement, nothing is just done. You know, it's not that like there's anything. Whatever is done has a foundation in scripture and has a foundation in our... It's not that anything is going on by chance just because, you know, that's the way we do it in the mandir. In our mandir we do it like this. No, everything based on scripture. So therefore, we should... This seminar has the purpose of giving an introduction. It is not a chorus. If I would give a chorus of 3 months, I could really go in depth on all these topics, right? And we could research it very thoroughly. That could also be nice. But this seminar is simply to give us an idea that this is a very authorized movement of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And yesterday I concluded by saying that we are all students, right? I'm sitting as a teacher, but I'm also a student. I'm just learning. Right? And you are learning. We're all just learning. Right? There is more than we know. There's more than I know. A lot more than I know. I'm simply learning. Right? There is so much to know. Right? But I just wanted to give you an idea of the depth of the roots of our movement and how we follow in the footsteps of the Mahajans. So now 20 minutes left for your questions and comments and challenges and whatever you want, as long as you don't throw anything. Please.
Yeah. Just on that about Lord Shiva being a great place. I've been hand pictures up of Lord Shiva and...
What? Something Lord, pictures, what did you say?
We can worship Lord Shiva as devotees, that means like we have pictures of other Vaishnavas in our temples and...
Yeah, we also have some pictures of Shiva, can have. Now, let me explain Shiva Tattva to you. I can do that maybe on the board, since it's there now, flip chart. We see here Haridham, and here we see Devidham, or the spiritual world. Haridham, the spiritual world, consists of the Brahmajyoti, within it the Vaikuntha planets, and finally Ayodhya, Mathura, and Dwarka, Goloka, Vrindavan. Yeah? Alright, and then here Devidham, the material world, with the three worlds, and the 14 planetary systems, the material world. In between the two, we have the Viraja. Viraja is a river that separates the material and the spiritual world. The Viraja is also known as the causal ocean. Yeah. And, of course, we know that Lord Mahavishnu, expansion of Krishna, is resting on the causal ocean. Of course, on the spiritual side, on the Haridham side. In the Brahma Samhita, it is stated that that at one point, the three modes of material nature are in equilibrium, and that then they are not manifest, and that then the material energy is not manifest. This unmanifested state of the material energy is known as pradana, the potential of the total material energy, which is known as mahatattva. Fine. It is said that Mahavishnu is glancing upon the pradana. In the Brahma Sutra, it is described that Shambhu becomes that glance. That is known as Sadashiva. Sadashiva. Sadashiva becomes that glance. Sadashiva, and at this stage there is no Devidham, nothing here. There's only these two, Haridham and Viraja. Then Sadashiva glances, the Mahatattva comes into being, and then we have Devidham, the three modes of material nature, become active, and so on. When this Sadashiva, the glance coming from Mahavishnu,
comes in touch with the material energy, then yatā vidā vikāra viśeṣa yoga, a vikāra takes place, which is a transformation, just as milk transforms into yogurt. So we see that Sāda Shiva transforms and then becomes Rudra. And the Rudra, there are different forms in the world. So there are two manifestations of Shiva.
Let's take another color.
So we have here Sāda Shiva, and here we have Shiva, who is Rudra.
Right. So
Sāda Shiva has a residence on the bank of the Viraja, and it is described in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita that Sāda Shiva has an abode here, and it is said that Shiva, who is the demigod Shiva or Rudra, who is the Shiva in this world, he resides on this side, on the material side of the Viraja, and there is Mount Kailash. Kailash, it is said, was originally the abode of Kuvira, actually. But because Kuvira became a great devotee of Shiva, he offered it to Shiva. It was actually his abode. Yeah? And he, of course, is also one of the demigods, treasurer of the demigod, he offered it to Shiva. So in this way, there is a distinction made between Sāda Shiva and Shiva in the form of Rudra. Sometimes we see, there is a conversation between Srila Prabhupada and his god-brother Sridhar Swami. Prabhupada respected him very much. And that conversation is recorded. We have 37 conversation books, and that conversation is in there. You can read it. There, this topic is coming up. And between them, they are both making statements about the two Shivas, the two aspects of Shiva. So the first thing that is understood, that here in the spiritual world, well, we have basically Krishna. Let's do it a little small. And then you get Vasudev, Sankarshan. Okay, I hope you can read it. Probably not. You should know this anyway. Pradyumna. And who? You know that name, huh? Okay, that's called Chaturvyuha. Then we get Narayan. Right, we get again Chaturvyuha. And then we get many Vishnu forms, including Mahavishnu. And from Mahavishnu we get Sāda Shiva. Alright, so Krishna, the first Chaturvyuha, Vasudev, Sankara, Pradyumna, Aniruddha, Narayan, second Chaturvyuha, Mahavishnu, and then Sāda Shiva. Like that. Alright, so Sāda Shiva is counting as an expansion of Vishnu, and he is considered Vishnu Tattva. He is Vishnu. He's still Vishnu. Vishnu Tattva. But when he comes in touch with Pradhana, with this potential of the material energy, then, and Pradhana becomes, and the modes of material nature become agitated, at that point, the transformation takes place, milk becomes yogurt, and he becomes his own tattva, Shiva tattva. He becomes his own tattva, different. So this explanation is based on Brihad Bhagavatamrita, on the Satsandarbhas, and on the Brahma Samhita. Yeah. So, in this way we can understand Shiva Tattva a little bit. We're dealing with two Shivas. Then, when we speak in the discussion, let me finish my point and then I'll take questions. In the discussion with between Prabhupada and his godbrother Sridhar Swami, Sridhar Maharaj at one point says, yes, the devotee is especially Sāda Shiva. He said, because the other Shiva sometimes sides with the demons. He gives benedictions to Ravana, or he's on the side of Bhamasura. He says that sometimes the Rudra, right, in this world. Prabhupada said, yes, but he's also a devotee. Right? Yes, yes. Now, all these things are going on, so on, by arrangement of the Supreme Lord. Anyway, so like this, we can understand something. Question?
So how does Shiva then come into different universes?
He expands himself in all the
different universes. This is all the same Shiva.
Yes, yes, yes. Rudra is then manifesting himself in many forms everywhere. And whatever you see, like some form of anger or destructive force present, there Rudra is present. So Rudra manifests himself then in all the universes. And then we see he appears from the forehead of Brahma again, right? The Rudra. But Rudra is actually already there, yeah. But then we see he manifests through Brahma. At the time the four Kumaras refused to, how you say, grow up, then Brahma became angry, and then we see how he appears.
So he's in no way a jiva.
He's what? No, he's not a jiva. Never a jiva. No. Yes?
They got the praise from Lord Shiva. So, what form of Shiva is
there? A demigod Shiva in this world.
How is that? He's giving this form about.
He's what?
He's giving the praise about Lord Vishnu.
Yeah, because there's very little difference between the two. He's a great devotee. So, also the Shiva in this world, also the one who is known as the demigod Shiva, is a great devotee, and he's also teaching. And he's also highly elevated authority, and therefore we are in the list of the Mahajans, we're worshipping him also as Shambhu, as the one we worship. But just for clarification though, I wanted to put this here. Yeah. Yes.
I was reading your translation of Brahma Samhita on the website. You also mentioned the Devi Dham, and you know, you said who I think what I read was, one who understands that Devi is different from Vishnu Tattva is under illusion. Is that as like Shiva?
All the demigods in this world have their spiritual counterpart, also in the spiritual world. So there's a spiritual Devi, a spiritual Saraswati, and so on. Yeah, they're there. But again, we focus our worship on Krishna. Now the hens are flying up too many. Yes?
I just wanted to ask a question. You mentioned Srila Vyasadeva is one of the 12 Mahajans.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, my understanding is that Vyasadeva is actually a position, an administrative position.
Yes.
And they usually Shakti Avesha avatars, but Krishna Dvaipayana Vyasadeva, if you see a Shakti Avesha avatar, or you see an actual directly Supreme Personality of God?
No, Shakti Avesha. Shakti Avesha. Yeah, it's directly mentioned in the Prabhupada. It's a Shakti Avesha. Yeah. So he's a Shakti Avesha avatar, empowered Jiva, yes, and it is in a way. Different sages take the role, like in the Vishnu Purana, there's a whole explanation where Parasara Muni is speaking. And Parasara is explaining to Vyasadeva, he's the father of Vyas, and he's explaining to Vyas that in a previous kalpa, that he was the Vyas. And Parasara says, I was the Vyas. And so, in this way. And each time Vyas appears, and then comes the time when he is dividing all the Vedas. The Vedic literature originally is orally transmitted, right? But in Kali Yuga, as Kali Yuga is approaching, no one is able to capture all that. And he divides it up in branches, and different sages become in charge of different branches. And the Vishnu Purana lists all these sages. The 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam also lists them, not as detailed as the Vishnu Purana, though. So you can see the whole list. I would have to prepare if I want to present. I can't remember so many details. But like
so even Krishna Dvaipayana himself is also one of the Shakti Avesha.
Yeah.
So read differently somewhere else.
Yeah.
What did I do? Yes.
Instantly, I was just thinking of this morning about Tamasic Puranas. I was very curious what they are. Brahma Purana is listed as Tamasic Purana. And
Brahma? No, is Rajasic. Rajasic. But the Skanda Purana, for example. Yeah, yeah.
Why are they listed as Tamasic?
They are not in themselves Tamasic. They are containing transcendental knowledge, so they are not tamasic, but they are for people who are tamasic. So they give instructions for people who are influenced by tamagun to uplift them. And it is says they are less reliable, and less authoritative. And if you also look at them, you'll also see they're less transcendental. If you just look at one of these other Puranas, and you put them next to the Bhagavatam, you can see Bhagavatam is more about the transcendental world, and you can see these other more governing material aspects of life, histories in the universe, but more dealing with material aspects.
Brahma Purana also has Rama and Krishna's
Brahma Vaivarta Purana has like a whole section dealing with Krishna. Yeah, so there's a portion in it. There's different things mixed in these Puranas. So, okay. But because they are still coming from that realm and that source, so whatever is there carries less authority. Yeah. Even if there's information about Krishna there, we take it, but it carries less authority than the Sakya Puranas. Mm-hmm. Yes.
As there are so many universes, and whenever Krishna or Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appears in this world, he comes with all his personal associates, like you mentioned Rupa Goswami, who is Rupa Manjari in a spiritual world.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens when these great Vaishnavas appear in the spiritual world? Are they missing there?
Yeah, of course, it's like, then you see a note on the door, have come to the material world, put prasadam in the fridge, and we'll be right back. Yeah. Yes. No, they expand themselves. So they're simultaneously there and here also. These such devotees are very powerful, and they can expand themselves into so many forms and be simultaneously here and there.
And when they are in the material world, they are aware of their original.
No, not always. I mean, I read actually in the diary of Murari Gupta, who is himself one of such personalities. He's Hanuman, right? So he's writing that before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared, all these great devotees appeared, who were all eternal associates of the Lord, but they didn't know it, neither of themselves nor of each other. But somehow or other, they immediately became good friends. They naturally felt attracted to each other, so they forgot. But then when they forget, it is yoga maya. Krishna makes them forget, because when the devotee forgets either his own identity or Krishna's identity, it is Krishna's yoga maya. Whereas when the non-devotee gets covered by mahamaya, the illusory energy of Krishna. So for the devotees also, they're also covered sometimes, they forget. Like that. Yeah. Yes.
When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is explaining to Prakashananda Saraswati about the creation of Mayavadi philosophy and that Shankaracharya is an incarnation of Lord Shiva to bewilder the people. So, I mean, Shiva is a devotee of Lord Krishna. What was the purpose in that?
The purpose in that was that, first of all, the injunctions of the Vedas about eating meat in a regulated way became very much misused on large scale. And you can still see that nowadays. Just go to some Kali temple in Calcutta, for example. There's a famous one. So much animal slaughter is going on, all in the name of Kali Puja, but actually not according to proper directions and so on of scripture. Nor are such rituals recommended. These are lower aspects of the Vedas. So when meat eating became so predominant, such, then Buddha appeared. And Buddha was an incarnation of the Lord, right? Shakti Aves, again. Buddha began to preach a philosophy which had principles of the Vedas, such as Ahimsa, but he took people away from all Vedic ritual and so on. So the main mission of Sankaracharya next was to drive out Buddhism. Sankaracharya vigorously preached over India, and it was Sankaracharya who drove Buddhism over the borders of India. That's why today hardly any Buddhism in India. Very little. Very little. And outside of India, everywhere Buddhism, isn't it? So the Buddhism didn't accept the Vedic authority, nor did Buddhism accept it ultimately the Supreme Lord directly. But Buddha said, just follow me and worship me. So in this way they were indirectly anyway worshipping the avatar. But Sankaracharya brought people back to the Veda. But his philosophy was a little similar to Buddhism. Then Madhavacharya and Ramanuja are bringing everyone back to the proper understanding of the Vedic literatures. And then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu finally brings us to the confidential meaning of the Vedas, which is pure devotional service, as is explained in Bhagavad Gita in chapter 9, the confidential meaning of the Vedas, pure devotional service. You see? So, it's not that all the incarnations appear just to give people proper information. Some of them appear to trick people. Yeah? To trick them. So Buddha and Sankaracharya appear to trick people. That's it. You're looking very serious. You're shocked. Is it? All this is found actually in the Padma Purana. Yeah. What are you doing?
I gotta go.
Oh, you gotta go home. Okay, have a good journey.
Thank you.
Yes.
Since I have joined this movement, I have learned that we were all originally spiritual identities.
Yeah.
And since we started to wanted to have some independence and people can become enemies of Krishna. So that's why we, Krishna, by mercy, he gave us the independence and gave us this this material body and sent us here with the knowledge that we can go back again. But your philosophy just now, you said that Manu wanted to populate the world, and that's how.
Yeah.
So I can't really.
No, but the Manu part, right, is that. The living beings, right, come into the material world. And the material world, as I said, there is Haridam and then Devidam, these two, right? Sometimes Devidam is not there. For a period of time, Devidam is not there. That is called the night of Brahma. There is the night of Brahma and the day of Brahma. During the night of Brahma, the material world does not exist. What happens then? Here is Mahavishnu. All the material energy and all the living beings that are then in the material world, they enter into the body of Mahavishnu at that time, and they stay there. Then when the time comes again for the creation, then what we said, it becomes all activated again, and then we get this, then we get the universes, then we get Lord Brahma in the universes, then he begins to create his mental sons, but the population of the universes is not happening. Then he creates Manu, then he creates his wife, and then Satarupa, and then population begins to actually go on. So this is a cycle. See, it is like in the Vedic understanding, we understand that there is a cycle. Just like seasons are also in a cycle, there's a cycle. Sometimes the material energy is manifest, sometimes the material energy is not manifest. And then, each time that it manifests again, there's a new creation. So this Manu and his wife, they play part in the new creation. It's not the origin. As you rightly said, originally, the living being was with Krishna in the spiritual world. And then, being in the spiritual world, the living being upon eternity came to understand that he also had independence, that he did not have to serve Krishna, and that rather he could also be served. At that point he was not yet envious, but just when he made the choice for that, then envy came. Then envy came. So some living beings who thought of that possibility, from I could also be the servant, and they said, no, this I don't want. Now it is said that this state of consciousness, where one is contemplating the possibility of not being engaged in the service of Krishna, is a neutral state. One is neither absorbed in service to Krishna, nor is one absorbed in the material. Therefore it is a neutral state, a marginal state in between, called tatastha. Therefore in this tatastha consciousness, the living being can choose to come down or to go back. When he goes down, then envy immediately, competition with Krishna begins. And now we're living in this world of competition, and we are competing with each other, and ultimately competing with God. Ultimately, we want to be God. We want to be worshipped. We want to be recognized. We want to be famous. We want to be rich. We want to be powerful, and the whole world is filled with people who are competing with each other for these things.
At the time of annihilation, the night of Brahma, that time we are all annihilated. We don't have any material body.
Correct.
So we go back
to Mahavishnu.
To Mahavishnu, spiritual energy?
Yeah. In a form as Jiva. The jivas then are in a dormant state. So we are in like a long sleep inside the body of Mahavishnu, during inactive, inside his body. And then we come out again and are placed back into the forms where we were when we left off. So those jivas that were in animal form will again go into animal form. Those who were in human form will again go into human form. Like that. We'll pick up where we left off. In the next day of Brahma.
Not just in the combination of Lord Shiva spreading Mayavadi. Part of the Mayavadi philosophy is that they don't consider, they consider form of Vishnu to be material.
Yeah.
Product of material energy. So is Shiva not offending the explain?
Yeah, of course he is. Shankaracharya is teaching a philosophy that is against the proper Siddhanta. If you hear the Mayavad philosophy, that spoils everything. But Shankaracharya did that to bring the Buddhists, people who had become influenced by Buddhism, back on board, because it is very close to Buddhism, what he's preaching, you see. So it was a step in between. So he was teaching a false philosophy. He was on the order of the Lord. Yeah? On the order of the Lord, he was teaching a false philosophy so that those people who had been lost to Buddhism could be reclaimed. And then Madhvacharya and Ramanuja brought them back to understanding the proper relationship of Vishnu. So therefore, although he taught a false philosophy because it was on the order of the Lord, there was no offense. That's why.
He also said Narayana
was
supreme.
Yeah, on the side, ultimately. He also said that on one occasion. Narayana opened up. Yes?
You said that the tatastha shakti. When is this energy manifested in a living entity? Is it that when a living entity is in a spiritual world, they are purely spiritual?
Yeah, it is tatastha, not tatastha shakti. I didn't speak about Shakti. See, there is also something like Antaranga Shakti, Tatastha Shakti, and Bahiranga Shakti. Those are the three energies. The internal energy of Krishna, the marginal energy, and the marginal energy is the Jiva. So that's, I'm not talking Tatastha Shakti, I'm talking about a Tatastha position. So the same word is used, but now for a different matter, different topic. Tatastha position. It is a marginal position. It is in a way a position of consciousness. Right. Some think that it is a physical location, that there is a particular place, the Tatastha region. And devotees are sometimes debating about that. Is the Tatastha, is it a physical region or is it consciousness? But the essence of it is, whether it's a physical region or not, one is in a marginal state of consciousness. One is not active. Huh? If you're serving me, and you stand there for a moment thinking like, I could also not do this and be served. If my servant does that, then I say, hey, wake up, what are you doing? Then he's no longer serving me. But he's also not serving somebody else. He's just standing there looking at the stars. So it's the marginal state, it's in between. So that is the essence. Whether it's a location or not is not really so clear. It's being debated because you see, when it comes to knowledge, right? Because we're speaking about not only the universe, we're speaking about unlimited universes, speaking about the spiritual world. There's no end to detail, right? Nowadays, PhDs, are just studying detail of everything. Somebody knows everything about mosquitoes. He's a PhD in mosquitoes, everything. He can write endless books about mosquitoes. There's so many details, right? So, in the Vedas, we find a lot of detail, but not on everything. So, therefore, you have what I call the daylight of knowledge. That is information where we have all the details. Then the twilight of knowledge, where we have less detail. Yeah? And then the night of knowledge, where we have no detail at all. So we can't be sure. So, this question is the Tatastha a state of consciousness or actually a location? We don't have anything clearly written that I know of or that so far our devotee community knows of. So, therefore, it is a twilight question. Yeah? So some things you can debate, but by lack of information, it will not be resolved. Yes.
When we just made a discussion about the Chaitanya or Rupa Sampradaya from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
Yeah.
And it was the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, or the Chaitanya Veda also. These teachings are taken from other Sampradayas also. He said, can you just put a bit of light on that?
Well, yesterday after the class you came to me and mentioned that it is said that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took two points from every Sampradaya and that he took it from the... and this is quoted by Bhaktivinoda Thakur in his Navadvipdham Mahatmya. Then...
What are
they? I mean, I'd have to bring my... my electronic memory for that. I have to try and remember. At least from Madhava, he took the strong... he took the thing that Vishnu was the Supreme Lord and the strong attitude opposing Mayavad. From Nimbarka, he took Madhuryaras and one more. That's where it stops my memory. So, if you want them all, you can Google it. Or if you have a problem, just send me a message, kks@panmo.net. And from the computer, I can do because I cannot remember everything. So, terrible. But it is in Navadvipdham Mahatmya Praman Kanda. There you can also find it. But so this Navadvip Dhamma Atmya is describing how Jiva Goswami came to Navadvip after Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had left, and that Nityananda was still on the planet, met him, and took him around on a parikrama of Navadvip and showed him all of Navadvip. Now, the only one who ever brought it up is Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Jiva Goswami never said anything about it, nor did anybody after that say anything about it. Only later, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said. So therefore, still, the book is very significant in our movement, because Bhaktisiddhanta based a whole parikrama of Mayapur on that. And our Navadvip Mamba parikrama is, of course, based on that. So we take it with great authority, but that is internally. Internally in our movement, we accept it with great authority. When we're presenting it to the outside world, they will not accept this as great authority, because it is Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And it's not like, what is the Vedic roots of these statements? Therefore, for our own internal usage, yes. For our preaching, we don't put this in the foreground. You see? So don't go around and say, yes, we took two burns from each sampradaya, etc. That's not a major preaching strategy, because it has no Vedic, not a large Vedic foundation. It comes from our Acharya. So others will not accept it. We will accept it, but they will not accept it. It is almost time for the lunch break. Yes, okay. You're the last. The very last.
You mentioned about the Dhruva Maharaj.
Mm-hmm.
Why not Dhruva Maharaj as well?
Why not Dhruva Maharaj as well? Yeah, Dhruva Maharaj is also a great, great personality, undoubtedly. But we see that the others are all like especially important positions that they are given. Either they are incarnations of the Supreme Lord, Shakti Avesh avatars, or they are Lord Brahma, and so on. Yeah. So Dhruva Maharaj obviously is also a great authority for us. But some might question Dhruva, because he was only the grandson of Brahma, the son of Uttanapad, and they might give him less importance. Yeah. But still, the Supreme Lord appeared before him. So we also accept Dhruva. Yeah. But okay, he's not mentioned in that verse as one of the 12 main authorities. And we're looking especially at these 12 authorities as authorities that are authorities that all will accept. Yeah. It doesn't matter whatever their opinion is, but when they start rejecting Narada, then they're in trouble. And after they've rejected Narada, are they going to reject Brahma as well? And then they're finished. Right? Then. So, in this way, we can see they are more universally accepted authorities. Maybe. Debatably so. But Dhruva Maharaj is also a great authority. And there are therefore thousands of Mahajans. Not only 12. There are thousands of Mahajans.